questions? All of them.
Is there some way we could, because I don't want to like ask you to do our homework, is there some way we could do the concepts of the basketball and tennis ball problem without doing that problem?
So I actually don't mind doing homework problems, but I probably will just leave M1 and M2, but it shouldn't be that different.
No.
So these two objects are falling exactly the same distance. And so when the millisecond before they reach the ground, they have exactly the same velocity downward. And then what happens is the bottom one, we're told, I mean, it probably wouldn't actually work this way, it rebounds with exactly the same velocity it had before, except now upward. So that means we're all set up for a collision between two objects that are coming together with the same speed, but with different masses. And I think it's pretty clear that this guy is going to go shooting off, but with exactly what speed, right? So, you know, if the semi-truck collides with the Toyota is going to go flying. It's pretty clear. But exactly what speed? And we're told that we're supposed to assume this is elastic. So that means that energy is conserved. And of course, it's a collision, so we're going to talk about momentum. And this thing is all taking place vertically, but the collision is happening in an instant, so we might as well think about it happening horizontally, although it doesn't really make any difference. But that's typically how we've set up our things in the past, is to think about things happening that way. Doesn't matter, but I think it might look a little bit more familiar. So here we've got the big one, M2, I'm going to call it, and the little one, M1. Conservation of momentum tells us that you might think that the initial momentum is zero since they're coming like this, but this guy has a lot more mass, so its momentum is going to dominate. So the way I've drawn it, M2 has positive momentum, and M1 has a negative velocity and hence a negative momentum. And I'm using V to indicate this initial velocity, the shared initial velocity of these two guys. So that obviously has to equal the final momentum. So I've got M1's final velocity and mass and M2's final velocity and mass. So one equation and two unknowns. We don't know what the final velocities of these guys are. We're not even asked what the final velocity of this guy is. We really only care about the final velocity of M1. Now, for elastic collisions, we could write down conservation of energy, because that's what elastic means. But that's a pain, and we've shown once and for all that it's the same thing as this. So we can use this guy instead. So that says that V1, the way I've written it is minus V, minus V2, so V2 by itself is positive. So that's going to end up being minus 2V. minus 2V. That has to equal the same thing switched around. So V2 final minus V1 final. So now we've got two equations and two unknowns. And we can usually solve those by your favorite technique. My favorite technique is usually to try and arrange it to get the same coefficient in front of some particular term so that when I add or subtract, those terms are going to cancel.
Could you just input one of those two equations, or would that not work because the initial velocity
this one?
Down?
Yeah, so those are a special case, which I don't even know why I wrote it down. It was kind of a problem we worked where the number two particle was at rest originally.
Okay.
So this is where the cue ball is hitting the at rest.
So like in our homework, that would work for the problem where it is going down that incline?
Yeah.
Right, because that second block is at rest.
Yep. Since you mentioned it, let's spend a second talking about that one too, because I think this is the book, for better or worse, really likes to combine old ideas with the new. So the only piece of this problem that is really relevant is this instant of the collision. And we have to do a lot of other work in order to solve the problem. And that is immediately solvable by this. Mm-hmm. So roughly speaking, how this is going to work is this guy's going to slide down. Conservation of energy is going to give us the velocity immediately before the collision. We have a collision. Since this one is more massive than this one's going to go back and this one's going to go forward. So then we have the projectile lab, where we projected something horizontally, and the question was, where does it hit the ground? This guy here, meanwhile, is going to go up, but it doesn't have enough velocity to go up the hill. So it's going to stop instantaneously and come back down with an exactly reversed velocity. And so it's going to also have a target sort of problem. So, I mean, for better or worse, it seems like a whole lot of work that is not conservation of momentum. Conservation of energy, which, you know, I guess is in some sense good because it's nice to review the old concepts, but pretty much all of the problems in the book are blended problems. They're not pure conservation of momentum. Okay, so back to where we were. We have conservation of momentum, which is pretty clear. Conservation of energy looks like a mess, so we try never to use it. Try to use this thing if it's at all possible. And now we've got two equations and two unknowns. And let me just recopy these equations on a clearer spot of the board. So here we've got m2 minus m1 all times v is equal to m1 v1 final plus m2 v2 final. And here we've got minus 2v is equal to v2 final minus v1 final. And be really nice to multiply the bottom equation by m1 and add, and then we get v2, but nobody asked us about v2. So we might as well cut to the chase and try and get the same coefficient in front of v2 in the bottom equation as we have in the top equation.
Why are you able to make the mass 2 minus mass 1 times velocity, because in the first equation the velocity is negative for m1?
Yeah, so if I were to expand this out a little bit, I could write that. And now this is a common term, so I can factor it out. And there's no particular reason to do it, just takes a little bit less chalk to write it. So if I multiply this whole equation through by m2, so let me just recopy this equation directly. So this was m2 minus m1v equals m1 v1 final plus m2 v2 final. And this one here is now going to become minus 2 m2 v equals m2 v2 final minus m2 v1 final. Now I've arranged it so that if I subtract it, these two guys are going to cancel, and these two guys will add. So on this side, I'm going to get, again factoring, m1 plus m2 v1 final. Now this, dealing with this can be a little bit confusing, so let's go at it a little bit slower than maybe I did in class. So if I undo what I did and write this all out, this is m2v minus m1v, and now I'm subtracting a minus, so it's going to be plus 2m2v. So I've got 1 plus 2 is 3. So this is 3m2v minus m1v. And now I can factor that as 3m2 minus m1v. And that's all on the left-hand side of this equation. So let me rewrite that. So I've got 3m2 minus m1v equals the total mass times the final velocity of the tennis ball. And of course, I can then get the final velocity of the tennis ball by 3m2 minus m1 divided by m1 plus m2 all times v. Now, question.
What happened to the negative
This?
Yeah. Where's that?
Negative. Mm-hmm. So I was doing the subtraction, so it actually came in as a plus.
Before you go any farther, what exactly are you doing with those two left-hand sides of the equations down there? I mean, I just am kind of lost. What exactly are you trying to do?
I'm just trying to get the what the left-hand side is in a simpler form.
So are you setting the two left sides equal?
No, I've just been cranking through. Yep, so this line here is exactly the sum of those two things.
Okay.
And everything else is just equal.
Okay, so on the right side of those two equations, did you add them as well?
Yes, well, I actually subtracted them.
Yeah, you subtracted them. So with the left-hand side of the equation, you're subtracting them as well, but it's adding because the bottom one is negative.
Right, so it's minus a minus, so that 2 is going to come out as a plus. Well, because I didn't get equal and opposite coefficients here, I got equal coefficients.
So you have to subtract to make them opposite?
Yeah, so I have to subtract to make them opposite.
So under what conditions are you able to do something like this, like take two equations and then just like add or subtract them?
Always.
Always.
Well, I say always because that's what the mathematicians would say. I would be really upset if you added an equation that had joules in it to an equation that had newtons in it, because you're not supposed to add units.
So
but mathematically, if A is equal to B and C is equal to D, it is a surefire thing that A plus C is equal to B plus D. And also, if you subtract these two equations, then A minus C is the same thing as B minus D. More questions? Well, without plugging in numbers, let's kind of think about what the result is going to be. So the tennis ball weighs next to nothing compared to the basketball. So if we just plug in 0 for M1 instead, you can see that this is going to about equal 3 times V. I mean, we could put in the exact numbers, but it's going to be pretty close to 3 times the initial velocity. So the tennis ball, after falling a meter, now is going to have 3 times the velocity that it had going down. And we never bothered to calculate what this speed was, but that's a simple calculation to apply, right? So if something started at rest, then we have the equation that this is where I'm using the positive direction going down. V squared is equal to V naught squared plus 2a delta x. In this case, the acceleration is g. And the distance it's fallen is some distance h. And the initial velocity is 0. So the velocity after a fall is 2gh. And that works going up too, right? So exactly the same situation going up is just the time reverse version of what you have going down. So we have a velocity that is 3 times what the velocity was going down. And we can do the algebra in a minute, but what that means is that the height is going to be 9 times bigger going up. So let's check that out. So this velocity, this final velocity, and let's use this 3, that initial fall velocity is given by this equation. So now it's going up. It's going to have a velocity that is 3 times the square root of 2gh. How high will it go? Well, just put it in the equivalent equation. So we're going to have 3 times the square root of 2gh squared. And that has to equal 2g, the final height that this thing is going to go to. And you can see how this is going to work out. These things are going to cancel. And the final height is going to be 9 times the original height. Snap, huh?
Absolutely. Why not, right? It's easier than reading my own handwriting.
You have the audio, too, if you want it.
How does that equation v squared over 2g play in? This we use it in class. V squared over 2g.
So that's the same thing we've got here. Yeah, so the left-hand side was this in the end, and so here it is as the left-hand side, and here's what the right-hand side has always been. Okay. It's surprising. Yeah, that's an excellent observation. So don't often you get, and in fact, I kind of intentionally write things as ratio so that it's clear that you don't have to bother to convert, because, I mean, even if it was in pounds, the ratio of pounds is the same as the ratio of kilograms.
In terms of the first part of this problem, finding the magnitude of the downward velocity with which the basketball reaches the ground, how would you recommend approaching?
So we can fancy this up. So if this is a chapter that deals, I was about to fancy it up by using conservation of energy, but this is actually isn't that chapter. But in order to fancy it up using conservation of energy, we can do that, right? So we can call the height 0 at the start. So that means at the start here, the potential energy is mgh, and the kinetic energy is 0 because it's at rest. And here, the kinetic energy is what we're trying to find, but the potential energy is 0 because it's at 0 height. So if we set the initial energy, which turns out to be all potential energy, to the kinetic energy, we're at the same spot. Yeah, so I define that to be 0 just for the sake of making life easier, right? I could have called the bottom of the floor 0 and subtracted those heights, but always choose your 0 to height to be as convenient as possible, because it's totally up to you. Yes.
Do you do a collision, like with angles?
I'm happy to do the one in the book if that's what you want to do, but maybe you want to do a different one. Any old problem? There aren't, as I recall, there aren't that many examples in the book that are two-dimensional. So we worked the space probe one in class. Well,
could you have the equal mass as three?
Do exactly 38. So, 38 may, one of the confusing things that, one of the things that I think confused people about 38 is it tells us that the collision is elastic. And I can tell you from the problem that if you work out what the kinetic energy is before and after, you'll get the same amount. But I'm never going to use this equation because it's a mess. And I'm not allowed to use this equation because it's not a head-on collision. But I always have momentum conservation to go for me. So I can always say that the initial momentum is equal to the final momentum. In this particular case, the initial momentum is all in the x direction, and it's equal to whatever the mass is times the initial velocity, which I think is 5. In the final situation, we've got these guys going off at various angles, 37 degrees and 53 degrees. But they don't tell us anything about the speeds. They do say that the masses are the same. Well, remember that this is a vector equation, so we can deal totally separately with the x directions from the y directions. So whatever this speed is, and let me call it v1, the corresponding vertical momentum is going to be m times v1 times the sine of 37 degrees. And this momentum is going to be negative because it's going in the negative y direction. So it's going to be minus the speed times the sine of 53 degrees. And those two guys have to add up to zero because there's no momentum, no y momentum in the initial state. So if we have m times v1 times the sine of 37 degrees minus m times v2 times the sine of 53 degrees, all adding up to zero, the masses cancel, right, which is good because we didn't know what they were to start with. If we put the negative thing over to the other side of the equation, we've got v1 times the sine of 37 degrees is equal to v2 times the sine of 53 degrees. They have to have canceling momenta in the y direction. Well, we still don't know what V1 and V2 are. We have one relationship between them, but if you got two unknowns, you need two equations. But we got a whole other dimension to deal with, the x direction. So the initial momentum in the x direction is this m times 5. This guy has some x momentum, which is going to be m times V1 times the cosine of 37 degrees. This guy also has positive x momentum, and that's going to be m times v2 times the cosine of 53 degrees. So the total momentum in the final state is mv1 cosine 37 degrees plus mv2 cosine of 53 degrees. And that has to equal the initial momentum. And once again, they didn't tell us the mass, so it better disappear. It does, in fact, cancel. So now we got two equations and two unknowns, and you can solve them in your favorite way. One way we can do it, kind of the plug and chug way, is we can solve this equation for V1, and then we can plug it in there, and we'll only have an equation that involves V2. So let's do that. So V1 is V2. The sine of 53 degrees divided by the sine of 37 degrees. And if I plug that in here, I have 5 is equal to, this is going to sound like a mess, we've got the sine of 53 degrees divided by the sine of 37 degrees, all times V2, all of that multiplied by the cosine of 37 degrees, plus V2 times the cosine of 53 degrees. And now V2 is a common factor, so we can pull it out, and then we're just going to have a bunch of sines and cosines inside parentheses. So we've got 5 is equal to this whole long garbagey mess, right? So sine of 53 degrees, cosine of 37 degrees, all on top of sine of 37 degrees. Our calculator can tell us what that number is, plus the cosine of 53 degrees. All of that times V2 has to equal 5. So V2 has to equal 5 on top of all of that same trigonometric garbage. And once we've got V2, we can put it back into this equation to get V1. So conservation of collisions in two dimension usually aren't all that more complicated than one dimension, because we've got two, the momentum equations are nice, they're linear equations, and we've got two of them because we've got x and y to deal with. Oh, the rolling down thing? No, there isn't that piece, right? There's just this piece. And this is, isn't that called H1, and this distance is called H2? Something like that. So the actual collision piece is just this. So if I know what the velocity is of M1, I can figure out what the post-collision velocities are kind of immediately. So most of this problem is the old stuff. And what I mean by the old stuff is, for example, the lab problem where we shot a bullet horizontally and we wanted to figure out where it hit the ground. So how did we do that? Well, we treated the x and y components totally separately. Because we can, even though it's going horizontally, we can treat that as just like a pure fall. So for the y direction going down, there is no initial velocity in the y direction. It's just going horizontally. It's going to go some distance h2. So in general, the equation would be delta y is v sub o t plus 1 half a t squared. I'm making my y's go down. So that means that the acceleration is going to be plus g as opposed to minus g. There's no initial velocity. And the distance I'm interested in it falling is h2. So what I've got then is h2 is equal to 1 half g t squared. And what we can figure out then is how long it takes it to hit the ground, right? If I just rearrange this, I've got 2h2 over g is t squared. So t, the time it takes to hit the ground, is the square root of 2h2 divided by g. What's happening in the x direction is just uniform motion. And we know that the distance it goes in the x direction is just the x velocity times the time. And the x velocity is the velocity, because there's no velocity in the y direction. So that's our range equation that we had from the lab. The other piece we have is how fast this thing is going when it falls down that distance h1. And I don't know if you'll let me get away with it or not, but it's exactly what it was before. If I declare this to be height 0, then when this guy is at the top, it has no kinetic energy because it's at rest, and it has a potential energy that is mgh1. When it reaches just before the collision, it has a kinetic energy that we're interested in finding, but it has no potential energy because it's at height 0. So if we set the total initial energy, which is just mgh1, equal to the final total energy, which is just kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared, the masses go away, and we have this equation then that 2gh is the speed just before the collision. Okay, so if we kind of put together the pieces, the speed just before the collision is going to be the square root of 2gh. We then have the collision, and we can plug it into this equation where the initial velocity of particle 1 is what we just calculated. So that gives us the velocity post-collision of the two pieces. Since I think m2 is twice as heavy as m1 in this problem or something like that. In any case, m2 is heavier than m1. So the post-collision velocity of the falling particle is going to be negative. So what that means is that the guy who has just gone down the hill is going to head up the hill with some speed that we can calculate by applying this equation. The hit guy, of course, has to go forward, right? What else could it do? And you can see that in this equation, there's no way of getting a negative number. Everything's positive. So if we've got its velocity going forward, we can plug into that equation and get where it hits the ground. Meanwhile, the original particle is heading up this incline. Its post-collision velocity is slower than its pre-collision velocity, so it's not going to go all the way to the top of the hill. It's going to go up, slow down, stop, and then it's going to go down again. And because energy is conserved, however much kinetic energy it had going up, it has to have the same amount of kinetic energy going the other way. So now it has the exact same speed that you calculated over there, except now it's going to the right as opposed to the left. And now it's going to go over the edge, and we can figure out where it lands by applying that equation. There are a lot of moving parts in that problem.
So then we took the velocity that we found with the over there, and we plug it in to find the change in x of both of them.
Essentially, we have to take, this is going to be a negative number, and we have to recognize that that negative velocity is going to be turned into a positive velocity when it goes up and down the hill a little bit. Does that make sense? No.
I'm not sure yet. But how do we find the velocity when it's going back up the hill? Is it the same?
So that's this. So immediately post-collision, m2 is going forward with this velocity, and m1 is going backwards with this velocity. And we can see that it's negative because m1 is going to be more than m2, so we're going to get a negative number in the numerator. And you know, if there were an edge, then it would fall off going that way. But there isn't. It's going to go back up that hill and frictionlessly, so it's not going to lose any energy. It doesn't have enough to go over the hill because its velocity is less than it was originally. So it's just going to go up the hill a little bit, and then it's going to come down with exactly the same velocity it had going up, right? Just as for that piece of chalk, however fast I threw it up, when it reaches the same level, same velocity, except now it's going down.
From the bottom the object lands, like either of the objects? How do you figure out how far away from the table they are?
So that goes back to our the lab where we shot that gun. So in order to figure out where it hits the ground, what we did is we figured out how long it takes, how much time it takes to hit the ground. And that we can do because the Y motion is totally separate from the X motion. So it's the same time as it would take a piece of chalk from that same level to hit the ground. If we know the time and we know the speed, we can get the distance. So this is the equation that if you tell me the velocity that something is shot off that ledge, I can just plug into that equation and get where it's going to land.
And we find those velocities just by using those equations over there?
Essentially, right? Yes. With this little trick that we're going to get a negative number for this one, and we have to realize that the mechanics of it is going to turn that negative number into a positive number. So anytime you have an elastic collision where you're throwing a light object at a heavy object, it's going to bounce back.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of the physics of it. The mathematics of it is here, right? So if m2 is more than m1, we're going to get a negative number in the numerator, but everything else is positive.
Right.
So we're going to get a negative number for that. Yeah, I guess I didn't see that it asked us that, but yeah, we can use this equation this way and that. You tell me the V that it's going, and we can figure out how high it's going to go. Because all that's involved in this equation is conservation of energy.
And the velocity we use is the V1 that.
Yes. Which one?
I'm looking at the next above the sign. And it said a roller coaster vehicle has a mass of 405 kilograms of four loaded with passengers. And then for the first part of the question, it says it could be like a speed of 27 meters per second at point A. What is the force of the track on the vehicle at this point? Would it be, would you just pretty much use F equals MA, but instead of A, you would switch A to V squared over R? Or is there something else that you need to do in addition to that?
I pretty much want to say yes, but I kind of didn't like those phrases. Instead of using A, we're going to use V squared over R. A is V squared over R.
Yeah, I mean, change A in the equation to V squared over R.
So at the bottom, I haven't read the problem carefully enough to know what we know and what we don't know. But if we know the speed, we know the acceleration, which is going to be upwards. We know that gravity is going to be pushing it down, and we're interested in this normal force, which has to be pushing it up. So the normal force plus, it's going to look like minus because it's in the opposite direction. The normal force plus the force of gravity has to equal ma, where a is going to be v squared over r. And for the top, it works kind of the opposite, right? You know that you're kind of lifted up. So here we have the normal force, here we have gravity, and here we have the acceleration. So it's still F equals ma, but now it looks like the normal force minus mg is equal to m times minus v squared over r, because our acceleration is in the minus y direction. I haven't read the problem quickly enough. My guess is that in order to, obviously when it goes up, it's going to change speed. And for that, my guess is we're using conservation of energy.
Yeah, it's a, the second part of the question is what is the maximum speed at the top of the coaster that would be needed for gravity to hold it on track?
Oh, I see. Okay. So,
so the first part is the force on the track at the low point, and then the second part is the speed at the high point.
Well, what the biggest speed could be. Without losing contact. So that's saying if the normal force is going to zero, what could the biggest speed be? And you can see that under these circumstances, the minus signs are all going to go away, the masses are going to cancel, and we're going to get g is equal to v squared over r. So r is going to be, so v is going to equal the square root of gr. That went kind of fast for people who weren't looking at the problem.
So I'm kind of still on this last problem we did. And I don't want to go back, but where are we getting h2 from? And I'm not figuring out how to find it.
Where are we going to get the what?
The bottom h2.
I thought they told us, didn't they? So it's 57? Okay. So your question is answered, huh?
Thank you.
Sure. Not getting a lot of questions from the first row. So relative velocity just means velocity difference. So you might remember when we were working that the quiz problem, I called the velocity of Abraxas and the canoe v, and therefore the terminator had to be v plus 15. So relative velocity just means the velocity relative to something.
Because it's already moving when he's jumping off, plus he's adding on whatever.
Yeah, but it's actually a little bit different from that because he's actually pushing back. So it ends up with the canoe having slowed down considerably by having him jump off the front.
Do you have any energy problems with like friction, so it's not all conserved that we could go over?
I remember this problem from an old textbook, which I always kind of liked. I can't do it exactly, but I thought it was kind of cute at the time. So we have one of these frictionless slides, and we're going to put a ball up here, and without friction, of course, it's just going to go back and forth forever, and it's going to go through exactly the same height. So that's kind of dull. So let's put a region that has some friction in it. And so let's kind of make up numbers. So let's let this height be 0.7 meters, and let's let this region where we have friction be 1.2 meters. And it's going to turn out that the mass won't matter, so I'm just going to call it M. And so it's going to happen, oh, and I need the coefficient of friction. And let's have it be fairly slick, be 0.1. So the question is, how many times will it go back and forth before it stops? And at first glance, this looks to be kind of a hard problem. Because do we have to go through every time figuring out how much speed we lose here, figuring out how high we go then and how high we come back, how much speed we lose, it looks like kind of a mess. But we know if we look at the whole process, we go from having this much energy to being at rest. We know that the change in the total energy, initially we all have, in the final state we have zero energy because we're at zero height at zero velocity. In the initial state, we just had potential energy, which was just the mgh, where h was this 0.7 meters. This change in energy has to be due to the frictional force acting through some distance. The distance could be lots of times through there, it doesn't matter. And we know that the frictional force is the coefficient of friction times the normal force, and I take it at this point we know the normal force is going to be mg for a flat region like that. So what we've got then is we can calculate the total length that it's on this friction area. So minus mu mgl has to be equal to minus mgh. And as promised, the masses go away, the g's go away, the minus signs go away. So the total length, the total distance that you went back and forth on this pad has to be the length of it divided by the coefficient of friction. So our original height was 0.7, divide that by 0.1. We need to go through 7 meters, and 7 meters is 1.2 times x many transits, right? Because each transit is giving us 1.2. So the number of transits is going to equal 7 divided by 1.2, which is going to be some fraction. So which means we're going to end up having gone through some complete number of cycles, then we're going to have a fraction of a cycle, and we're going to end up at rest sitting on this frictioned area. I don't know, maybe that's not a very general problem, but I kind of liked it. So it turns out that this is 5.8. So we're going to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 0.8. Yeah, not your favorite problem, huh? Here's kind of maybe a simplified version of the same thing. So this is a Hot Wheels problem. So we have, you know, Hot Wheels are those little cars and tracks. And the tracks are pretty slick. We're going to assume it's frictionless. But the carpet isn't so frictionless. So let's say that it's actually pretty, the coefficient of friction of carpet is probably pretty hefty. Let's say 0.7. So let's say we start this Hot Wheels out at a height of 1 meter. How far does it go on the carpet? So it's going to be a very similar sort of problem. We have an initial energy that is all potential energy. It's going to be mgh. We have a final energy that is zero because it's at h equals zero with no velocity. So the change in energy, final minus initial, is minus mgh. And the change in energy has to be the work done by the non-conservative force. That's the force of friction. The frictional force is acting in the opposite direction of the displacement, so we've got that minus sign. Frictional force times the length. The frictional force is the coefficient of friction times the normal force. And for this flat area, the normal force is just mg. So we've got then, if I rewrite my equation, minus mu mg, the length that we go, eating up all that energy, has to be minus mg, the original height. So the length our car is going to travel is going to be h divided by the coefficient of friction. So a little bit further than the height that it was released from.
So whenever something goes to rest, it's always equal to non-conservative forces times the length that it goes.
Say that again.
So when it ends up at rest, it'll the potential energy will equal the conservative, the non-conservative forces times however far it went. So that's how that works.
Well, always is a big word. So one thing that is true is I didn't have to take my height here to be zero, right? I could have taken it someplace else. And so then there would have been some potential energy in the final state. In the end, that won't change the result of the problem. So I guess what I would say is that typically when you start something, any sort of system, a pendulum, something like that, you start it at rest so there's no kinetic energy, but it has some potential energy. As time goes on, the pendulum stops, and so now it has some potential energy. Well, if we take our height zero there, then it has zero potential energy and it has no kinetic energy. So all of the initial energy has been eaten up by that non-conservative force. So the idea that the work done by the non-conservative force is minus the initial energy, that's a pretty common idea, because the final energy is often, but not always, zero.
So how do you know to multiply by the length that it goes?
Because that's the definition of work, right? Work is the force times the displacement. And more technically, the force times the displacement times the cosine of the angle between them. So most commonly you don't need it. So remember that the angular acceleration has nothing particularly to do with the centripetal acceleration, right? So the kind of equivalent statement in one-dimensional motion would be, how would you find the acceleration from other things in the problem? And you know, it depends on what the other things in the problem are. You probably have a particular problem in mind. So tell me what, I see, it's an online, so it's. Yeah, I can't.
The centrifuge in the medical laboratory located at an angular speed of 38.
Yes, got it. So it's number 6 in the book. So a centrifuge in the medical laboratory rotates at an angular speed of 3,600 revolutions per minute. When switched off, it rotates through 50 revolutions before coming to rest. Find the constant angular acceleration in radians per second squared.
So do you first need to figure out how many revolutions per second it goes, because the answer is in seconds? From change the revolutions per minute to revolutions per second?
Yeah, and you might even want to change it to radians per second.
Okay.
But none of that is exactly required. We're going to have to do some unit conversion eventually, mm-hmm. from revolutions and to radians and per seconds. My kind of idea would be to leave it in revolutions and minutes for as long as possible, since that seems like everything's in. But you may not like that, right? Because then you're going to have to make a unit conversion from revolutions per minute squared to radians per second squared. So how do we do that? How many radians are there in a revolution? Two-thirds right. No R.
Oh, just 2 pi.
So radians don't have units. So let's say that this answer came out, it won't, let's say it came out 5 revolutions per minute squared. And you've just told me that there are 2 pi radians in a revolution. So this is a radian, that's not an R. That's a unit.
Okay.
Maybe I'll write out rad. Usually people just use R. So what's the next thing? How do we convert those minutes to seconds?
So 3,600.
Okay. So what do exactly, so I agree that there's 60 seconds in a minute. What do I do with that? Love it, yeah. So we need to square it because we got minutes squared. Yeah. So people often forget to do that. So in 1 minute, we've got 60 seconds, but we have a minute squared, so we need to do that. Okay, so that's kind of the end of the problem. So the beginning of the problem is that they tell us 3,600 RPMs, and it's going to go to zero in 50 revs. So this is kind of equivalent to a question where we say that the initial velocity was 5 meters a second and the final velocity was zero, and it did that in 3 meters. So we need an equation, we would like an equation, that involves the things we know, right? Velocities and distances, and gives us acceleration and doesn't involve time. And for the linear case, the equation that you should be thinking of is that one. And exactly the same thing is true for angular acceleration. So the final omega is equal to zero. The initial omega is equal to this 3,600 RPMs, and the angle that it's gone through is 50 revs. So if I kind of rearrange that equation, what I've got is omega squared minus omega naught squared divided by 2 delta theta is equal to alpha. So I'm going to have 0 minus 3,600 revs per minute squared divided by 2 times 50 revs. What are the units that I'm getting for alpha? Right. Revs per minute squared, right? So then all I need to do is to unit convert. I've erased my 2 the way we talked about. The book has a tendency to automatically convert things to radians, which, you know, is foolproof because some equations require radians. But it often makes these problems more complicated than I think they are. And the facts are that usually people talk about revolutions per minute, not radians per second. And do notice that we're going to get a negative out of this, right? It's angular deacceleration. More questions. So we've got lots of questions today about homework problems, and I've never gotten a question about homework problems in class. And I assume that's because you think I'm going to growl at you if you ask me how do I work the homework. I probably won't. I might growl at you if after you ask me how to work the first homework problem, you ask me how to work the second homework problem. But I think that those are fair. I don't think of the homework as something like an exam where you know the grade is a measurement of your accomplishment. The idea of homework is it's practice. And really the only reason I attach any grade to it is to convince you to do it. Because I think it's I think if you don't practice, you're going to fail on the exam. Other questions? Well, everything you wrote there is equal, right? So
how did you know?
Well, you know a minute is 60 seconds.
Yeah, a minute is 60 seconds. But
so the other one you just have to memorize, that 2 pi radians is 360 degrees is one revolution.
Okay, one revolution. And they're talking about revolutions per minute squared.
Because it's an acceleration, like just like meters per second squared.
Just gonna confuse me. I'm used to the other way, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Just applied to.
Yep. And you may be more comfortable doing things in terms of radians per second squared.
Okay.
And then not having to do a unit conversion.
Okay.